Thank you very much, Michael. I was a little bit anxious about the thank you, Michael, moment, because I know that our Vice Chancellor likes to Google around and find some little known facts about his professoriate, and I wasn't quite sure what he was going to come up with, but I've been let off light, I think. Also, I was a little bit anxious because I couldn't quite remember. I've been to some of these occasions before, and I couldn't quite remember if I was meant to say thank you, Michael, or thank you, Vice Chancellor. But I was able to check online some of the previous talks that are available online and put my mind at rest. And while I was about it, checked what the appropriate dress code was for the occasion. I thought it was important to get that right. I decided that it was smart casual seemed to be the norm, so here I am. Dress is very important, I learned. I was at doing a paper at a conference over the summer, and there was someone in the front row who was very busy on his laptop or iPad. Afterwards, he came up to me with his laptop, and I thought he was going to sort of ask me some abstruse question from a note or something, or ask me to clarify a quote or something. He turned it round and he had a web page of the manufacturers of the rather natty trainers that I was wearing. And he said, could you just tell me which trainers you're wearing? Because I really like the trainers you're wearing. So that was a lesson that was on one's vanity, intellectual vanity, I mean, not sartorial vanity, the thinking, imagining that people are listening to your words of wisdom and actually trawling to check the shoes you're wearing. These are office, by the way, if anybody just so you don't need to get your laptops out. Okay, here we go. I've entitled this talk The Death of Opera. And of course, I'm thinking to myself that the reason why you've all come must be because you're wondering why someone whose title is Professor of Opera is doing a talk entitled The Death of Opera. Surely it doesn't look very good on my application for professorial pay review if I'm advertising the death of the subject that I'm teaching here. It doesn't seem to have done me any harm so far, pleased to say. Now, really, I'm thinking we're in a medical lecture theatre here. Really, he should be laid out on the slab in front of us, on the dissecting table. In the old days, he would have been laid out in the medical dissecting theatre, of course. But anyway, I've taken the title, or anyway the idea of The Death of Opera, from something that the German musicologist, philosopher, critical theorist, sociologist, composer, goodness knows what, Theodor Adorno wrote. When he said that opera is an eviscerated art form that doesn't know that it's dead. Here is the full quote. It's worth looking at the full quote. He says, "Most art is part of a profit-driven industry that carries on for as long as it pays, and by its smooth functioning, it obscures the fact that it is already dead. There are flourishing genres of art, traditional opera is one, that are totally eviscerated without this being in the slightest apparent in the official culture." Now, Adorno here was taking, in his analysis of opera, what was a fairly conventional, straightforward Marxist line. His argument was that, broadly speaking, although opera historically was associated with the monarchy and the aristocracy, opera became a progressive art form when it was taken over by the bourgeoisie, the middle classes, in the later 18th century, at a time when the bourgeoisie, the middle classes, were themselves a progressive force. That is a straightforward bit of Marxist theory. But now, Adorno says, opera is simply an institution of official bourgeois culture. The middle classes have ceased to be progressive and they've just sat on their own institutions. Now, in fact, we find that almost all historians of opera agree with Adorno when they come to write their histories. The most recent, Carolyn Abbati and Roger Parker, have just published a huge, great, big 600-page history of opera for Oxford that has just literally, today, I think, come out. And they reiterate this point, that basically they say that opera ceased to be a vital art form in more or less in the years after the First World War. And there are two sort of classic symbolic moments of opera's demise. The first is the moment in which Toscanini, the conductor, laid down his baton at the premiere of Puccini's opera Turandot, last opera, at the point where Puccini had left the opera unfinished at his death in 1926. And this marks the end of the glorious history of Italian opera. The second symbolic moment is the moment when Schoenberg found himself unable to complete his opera Moses and Aaron. He wrote the text, the libretto, for three acts, but he could only get as far as the end of the second act. And in the final scene of the opera, Moses, and I've said perhaps surely this is Schoenberg himself speaking, Moses expresses his frustration at not being able to communicate to the Israelites what the nature of God is. And he says, unrepresentable God, inexpressible idea, I have fashioned a false image as an image must be. Thus I am defeated. And you can hear Schoenberg saying, thus I am defeated. Thus all was but delusion that I believed before. Perhaps Schoenberg saying my whole system, my 12-tone, elaborate new compositional system that I created was delusion. And can and must not be given voice. And then the final phrase of the opera, Moses sings these last words, O word, thou word that I lack. Schoenberg gave up on trying to complete the opera. Now, very few operas have entered the mainstream opera repertory. Opera is essentially a museum art form. The need for novelty in the repertory, or novelty in terms of for audiences, met either by radical theatrical reinterpretations of the mainstream core repertory, or by another phenomenon very, very recognisable, the backward extension of the repertory. The repertory used to be basically believed to have started with Gluck's opera Orfeo, written in the 1760s, but gradually it expanded backwards to include the operas of Handel, Baroque opera, French, Baroque opera, and then back to the 17th century. And this has been the way in which people have been provided with new works, not with contemporary works. Now, the fact that something is dead or is in a museum doesn't mean that it's not of interest as an object of study. Most great playwrights are dead, but theatre remains a living art form, despite the challenge of new media in the 20th century. But Adorno believed that it wasn't possible simply to renovate the forms of 19th century opera with avant-garde musical techniques or topical modern subject matter, because those forms themselves are too closely wedded to 19th century bourgeois notions of subjectivity and autonomy that no longer represent the subject in the era of late capitalism. He also believed that although 19th century opera in some ways anticipates the modern culture industry, particularly in its appeal to sort of spectacle and display, it can no longer compete with the modern culture industry. And he particularly thought that basically cinema did much better in the 20th century what opera used to try and do, and that opera could no longer compete on in that particular field. But there's worse to come, because if we look back in history, we find that opera has been declared dead rather often. In 1851, for instance, Wagner wrote that opera died with Rossini. Well, Rossini wrote his last opera in 1830. And he also wrote in the same text that French opera was a garish corpse. So that's French and Italian opera out of the way for Wagner, at least. But Slavoj Žižek, the Slovenian critical theorist, philosopher, who has written a book with a colleague called Mladen Dolar, entitled Opera's Second Death, Žižek and Dolar date the death of opera to its birth as a new art form based on an attempt to restore the past, they say. Opera was still born. Opera was conceived in an attempt to revive Greek tragedy, is one of the arguments, and therefore it was already not modern, as it were, is what Žižek and Dolar want to say. So the question has to be, does it matter to study opera? Why does it matter to study opera? And what I want to do in this talk is to suggest some reasons why it might still matter to engage with opera, even if it is dead. What I want to ask is, what kind of discipline is opera studies today? Opera itself is a highly complex, multi-medium form, and part of what I want to suggest and demonstrate is that one has to bring very complex disciplinary approaches to such a complex art form. So what I'm going to do is look at three areas of my own research that perhaps will suggest to you some of the different kinds of approaches that can be brought to the study of opera. By then, and by no means comprehensive. And the three areas that I'm going to, the three approaches I'm going to talk about are, first of all, what we might call a cultural studies, media studies approach to opera. The second is a historical approach, understanding opera's centrality as an art form in the past. And then the third is what I would call a creative critical approach, a creative approach that employs a critical methodology, actually through practice to investigate and explore what opera can, might be today. So let's start with the cultural studies approach. And let's return to Žižek and Dolar, because and you have to remember that Žižek is always impish, so you never quite can be quite reliant on what he says. But anyway, what they say is that although opera is dead, it lives on as the undead. If opera were simply over, It could be assigned a neat place in cultural archaeology and thus properly buried. The astounding thing is the enormous operatic institution's stubborn, zombie-like existence after its demise. The more opera is dead, the more it flourishes. Now, what they're referring to here is in part the fact that even if the art form itself may not be vital anymore, it still has a widespread cultural presence beyond the opera house, beyond opera. It's evident if we look at the use of opera in things, in film soundtracks, in advertising, in other media, and we're going to look at one media space that where opera has an afterlife a little bit later on. But they're also referring to the continued institutional authority of opera. Let's just pluck out two facts here. The Arts Council's total expenditure for arts for England in 2013 will be approximately £329 million. The sum allocated to opera, it will be approximately £62 million. So that's 20% of the total arts budget going to an art form that has been dead for rather a long time. Undead, indeed. Now, clearly opera is an expensive art form, but the justification for such a sum has to be questioned, especially since most of that money is going to subsidise seats for people who are already pretty well off, or even corporate patrons. Now, that scale of subsidy is justified because opera has come to stand for high art. So understanding the status of opera in modern culture helps us to understand how cultural hierarchies and values are formed and maintained, and above all, the relationship between culture and class. Now, the class associations of opera derive originally from its associations with the monarchy and aristocracy, and that is still part of the penumbra of opera, the royal opera, and so on. From the 18th century, the middle classes take over opera as one of the sort of appurtenances of their own manifestation of their own cultivatedness. And opera houses themselves move from being private appurtenances of the royal court into the public sphere. This is the Vienna State Opera. The Vienna State Opera was the first building to be erected on the Ringstrasse in Vienna. It was started in 1861. And what the historian Karl Schorsky says is that the Ringstrasse, here is the Ringstrasse, was conceived by the Emperor Franz Joseph. And then what Karl Schorsky says, it was conceived as a ceremonial route for the display of the great representative buildings of the bourgeoisie. And here we have them, the Bourse, the Stock Exchange, the City Hall, the Church, the Parliament, the new democratic constitutional monarchy that was being demanded in Vienna. The art museums, natural history museums, and here we are, the Staatsoper. And what Karl Schorsky says is that the cultural buildings, such as the opera, served as the meeting ground for the old aristocratic and the new bourgeois elite. So the bourgeoisie are teaming up with the old aristocratic culture to take it over for itself. Now, this has to be seen also in relation to what has been called the sacralization of art in the 19th century, the tendency to promote art as a kind of substitute for a waning religious culture in a period of secularization. Now, the American historian Lawrence Levine has written a very interesting account of how this process happened in America in a book called Highbrow, Lowbrow. And what he shows is that things like Shakespearean drama and Italian opera were part of an economy of popular entertainment in early 19th century America. In fact, the popularity of opera in America was seen as a sign of the democratization of taste in the New World. But by the mid-19th century, you have a growing American plutocracy, and they start to lay claim to markers of cultural distinction. And what they start to do is to exclude the broader public from cultural activities such as opera that they want to reserve for themselves. So ticket prices are raised, new rules of social and dress etiquette are introduced for the theatre. Opera starts to be sung always in foreign languages. Now, that is still a crucial basis for distinction in opera houses like the Metropolitan or the Royal Opera in London. And what we can say is that just as the Catholic Mass used to be spoken in Latin as a deliberate way of excluding the majority of the congregation from actually understanding what was going on, so in the same way, clearly, singing opera in foreign languages is a kind of exclusion. The French social theorist Pierre Bourdieu developed a theory of what he called the notion of cultural distinction, the ways in which different social groupings establish certain cultural attributes as being signs of status. And he says that the signs of status for the upper class is that art is somehow elevated above the concerns of everyday life and that it's spiritual. And then what we can see if we look at the development in America, we can see these ideas feeding through. They are also very evident in Wagner, of course, but we can see it in a much more sort of, in a sense, more evident sociological sense. When we find, for instance, in 1900, the American theatre impresario Oscar Hammerstein I, because his son was Oscar Hammerstein II of Rodgers and Hammerstein. Oscar Hammerstein I, who promoted opera in New York, and he declared that opera is the most elevating influence upon modern society after religion. Now, to maintain this sort of belief, you have to guard opera against any imputation that it might actually involve pleasure or entertainment, let alone be a sociable activity. And that is still very much part of the way in which opera is defended today, and particularly the funding of opera. John Tuzer, who was former director of the Barbican Arts Centre, gave as a defence of the funding of opera, argued that the fact is that opera is not like dipping into a box of chocolates. It is demanding and difficult. And this kind of what we might call sacralisation of opera as some kind of demanding, difficult, high art is a crucial part of this whole construct of high art and of opera as the exemplar of high art. So what I'm going to do now is move from high art to what certainly I'm afraid John Tuzer would think was an appropriate way of responding to opera, because I'm going to look at a TV program called Pop Star to Opera Star. Now, Pop Star to Opera Star is a reality TV show in which pop singers compete to present themselves as opera singers. And for anybody who hasn't seen the program, I have a little clip here, which will give you a taste, and we hope that YouTube will behave and load up properly.
For a singer, and for me, that is just...
Oh. Okay. Now, what I want to suggest is that, sorry, that's blown my joke there. what I want to suggest is that this program can be seen under two aspects. First of all, it is a kind of cheeky reclaiming of opera for popular culture. What it's saying is, hey, opera is fun, it's kitsch, it's camp. That's the cat that John Tuzer doesn't want let out of the bag, because, of course, why do all those people go along to the Royal Opera? Well, of course, because it's fun and kitsch and camp. But the other point we can make is that it also serves as a kind of endorsement of cultural hierarchy and aspiration. The programme exemplifies what John Story, cultural theorist John Story, has called high pop. That is, high art that has been commercialised. And the crucial thing about high pop is that the status markers of high art, however demystified, are still essential to the additional cachet of high pop products. And I think we can see some of these, this sort of ambivalence or duality in the program if we look at the judges for the first series, actually, not the second series, which you saw in the clip. Now, the first of the two external judges is Lawrence Llewellyn Bowen. Now, TV interior designer who, with his double barrel name and flowing locks and floppy velvet suits, passes in the popular imagination for posh and arty. The second judge, Meatloaf. No more needs to be said. But there's some other very interesting little indicators. They're quite often in these programs, you get cutaway shots to the audience, and there are sometimes various people planted in the audience. And in the first series, one of the people who was very conspicuously planted in the audience, and the camera kept cutting away to her, was Dame Judi Dench. Now, what was she doing there? Well, Dame Judi Dench, of course, as a Shakespearean actress, is official high art royalty. So in one sense, she's offering a kind of endorsement of the sort of status of this. But, of course, she's also has been in a number of TV sitcoms, so she has recognition factor. She has a recognition factor as well. So the producers of this program are making very crafty choices in these kinds of little decisions that they make, which one has to kind of look out for in these programs. Dame Judi does not come cheap as set dressing. They will have decided that the value, whatever it cost to pay her, was going to be worth it for the kind of what she would bring to the way we understand the programme. Now, another way, I want to look at another way in which the programme challenges some of the orthodoxies of high art. Popstar is actually part of a very well-worn TV, reality TV genre in which people are challenged to undertake a professional activity in which they have no prior skill, such as show jumping or orchestral conducting. Previous examples people may remember In at the Deep End or another one called Faking It. Now, what these programs suggest is that highly skilled activities that are valued precisely because of the amount of labor time that has gone into perfecting them can be faked with no more than a few days' training. Now, that clearly challenges the conservative, nostalgic fetishization of craft and skill as guarantors of quality and value. And it's worth looking at the response to the programme by the opera critic of the Daily Telegraph, whose language is about as demotic as the programme itself. Pop star to opera star makes me sick. The crucial paragraph I want to draw your attention to is here. The first thing to say is that it has nothing to do with the reality of opera. Oh, no. At first, all it presents is a few B and C list celebrities, well, fair enough, singing some familiar operatic numbers using mics. There's no attempt to present anything in dramatic context, and the arias are cut and transposed. Far from explaining technique or showing what is involved, the background footage merely presents the usual hysterical drivel of competitors sobbing and complaining that they're out of their comfort zone and really scared. The audience shrieks and screeches moronic approval. Now, there's two things that are very interesting there. First of all, this thing about there's no attempt to present anything in dramatic context. The arias are cut and transposed. Arias were always cut and transposed in opera. Not only cut and transposed, other arias were stuck in if singers felt like it. Other composers were commissioned to stick arias in. Chunks were cut. Bits from other operas were brought in. This is a total sort of nostalgic fantasy of what opera is, or historically has been. But the second thing is this thing about the microphone, because that's something that really gets these critics, that these kids use microphones. And of course, when he sings, that chap sings Nessun Dorma, it's transposed down a fifth, so that it sounds as if he's getting the top C, and it's not getting the top C, but who cares? It sounds just as good. You know, what's his problem? Well, of course, what his problem is that this touches, the raw nerves that this touches, go back to some very fundamental issues of cultural distinction. In familiar taxonomies of the arts, mass culture is usually associated with the advent of technological means of reproduction and distribution. That is what makes it available to people. Remember Walter Benjamin saying that within a mechanically reproducible culture, cultural distinction is preserved by the distinction between the original and the copy. So the whole value of the notion of the original comes into being and gains that is given value. The presence of the original, says Benjamin, is the prerequisite of the concept of authenticity. So what Christensen is picking up on here is that singing with the microphone in some ways is exactly what exemplifies the potentiality of mass culture. Singing without a microphone clearly signifies authenticity, and it offers a kind of promise of auratic exclusivity that can only be enjoyed by a few people. Now, we're going to make a bit of a jump. So we're going to move now to a historical framework to consider how some of these values might have arisen historically, have become attributed and attached to opera. And what I'm going to do is go actually look at the research I'm doing at the moment. I'm on research leave at the moment, and I'm doing a project on early opera, trying to understand what the relationship between why opera came into being, let's put it that way, a simple way of putting it, and how we can understand that in relation to early modernity. Now, opera, broadly speaking, came into being around 1600. And it was a crucial component of what composers at the time called the modern style. They knew they were doing something new and modern. And the modern style was basically a project to humanize music, to make music expressive, to make it responsive to text as opposed to church music, which tends to be very abstract, to endow music with dramatic and narrative potential. And we can say actually that most of the attributes of the music of the subsequent two centuries actually derived from opera. But opera is also crucial in the cultural construction of some key modern notions of subjectivity and autonomy. And what I'm interested is looking at how these attributes of early modern music relate to some broader developments in what we call early modernity, and in particular, colonial exploration and the scientific revolution, which are the two key sort of determinants of this period. And the work that I'm going to look at is Monteverdi's opera Orfeo of 1607. Those of you who sharp eyes will see that says 1609, that's the date of the publication. Now, Orfeo is based on the legend of Orpheus, who you will remember was the great musician of antiquity, who could the power of whose music could calm the beasts, could calm wild, savage hearts, could even make the mountains and the woods dance. When his wife Eurydice died, he actually went down to Hades to try and reclaim her, and the power of his singing was so great that the gods of the underworld gave him back Eurydice. Now, I want to look at the scene in the opera where Orpheus sings his great, it's really the climax of the opera, sings his great plea to Charon, the ferryman who ferries the souls of the dead over the Styx. And Orpheus lulls him to sleep, lulls Charon to sleep, and he seizes Charon's boat and he crosses the water, singing these lines, the ones in red. As he crosses the river, we hear a chorus of infernal spirits who comment on his action. So I want you to imagine, as you listen to the words they sing or read the words they sing, that they are accompanying Orfeo on the river. And I've given you an image just to help you along. It goes on a little bit longer, but I'll finish it there. Now, the reference in this verse of the chorus is to Jason and the Argonauts, Jason the great explorer-navigator of the ancient world. And during this period in Italian literature, Jason was regularly associated with Christopher Columbus and the great navigator explorers of the period. Here, there's Jason in his boat. This is Ludovico Ariosto, actually much earlier, in Orlando Furioso, describing giving a prophecy of the new Jason, the new Argonauts. But as the years revolve, behold, I see from the far distant regions of the west of Argonauts a brave new company who sail along a route as yet unguessed. That is Columbus and the great navigators. Still others leave behind, on other hand, the marks which Hercules set up. That's the pillars of Hercules, which were supposed to be the westernmost boundary of the world. From there, the globe they circle like the sun, pre-Copernicus, of course, and find new worlds and new abodes of humankind. So the reference to Jason is pretty certainly a reference to colonial navigation. And indeed, we find in this image by Rubens of the Arch of the Mint in Antwerp that Jason is represented there as a conquistador on the top of the great silver mine of Mount Potosi in Peru. So this is more another bit of evidence of this kind of association. Now, in the second verse, which Monteverdi didn't set wisely, because that chorus would have gone on much too long, there's a reference to Daedalus and the fact that Daedalus, of course, was the great mechanic scientist of the ancient world who constructed some wings that enabled him and his son to escape from Crete. Now, so we've got in these two verses references, therefore, to colonial exploration, voyaging, and science. And they were actually often conflated in the contemporary imagination. So we find, for instance, the poet Marino in 1623 extols Galileo. And he calls him, he describes him as a second Typhus. Typhus was the steersman, navigator of the Argonauts, not of sea, but of heaven, looking at mapping the skies with his new telescope. And here we have Francis Bacon's frontispiece to Francis Bacon's greatest work, the Instauratio Magna, in which we have that image conflated again. This is an image of the new world of science and discovery represented by the boat setting out from the Pillars of Hercules to explore unexplored lands. And I would just ask you to think about that chorus by Strigia Monteverde. A man undertakes no enterprise in vain, nature can no longer protect herself from him, in relation to Bacon himself writing, I'm come in very truth leading you to nature with all her children to bind her to your service and make her your slave. Does that not perhaps map onto this famous image of Amerigo Vespucci arriving in the New World and encountering America as a naked woman? Mastery over scientific mastery, but mastery over the New World and the peoples of the New World. And in fact, Bacon himself drew the comparison between Orpheus and science science and what he called philosophy, moral and civil. He says the singing of Orpheus is of two kinds, one to propitiate the infernal powers, the other to draw the wild beasts and the woods. The former may be best understood as referring to natural philosophy, which was Bacon's term for science, the latter to philosophy, moral and civil. And what he meant was referencing a long tradition of the idea that Orpheus, through his rhetorical skill, actually was able to civilize people, civilize wild peoples. And of course, therefore, that makes a lot of sense in the era when people are talking about civilizing the savages in the New World. We're told that Christopher Columbus himself used music to calm the natives he encountered. The admiral, perceiving that he could not prevail by signs and tokens, determined with musical instruments to appease their wildness. And in fact, we have an explicit reference to Orpheus in another text a bit later. Orpheus stopped the course of rivers with his playing, caused the trees to dance, tamed the wild beasts, made them sociable and kind to one another. There is nothing that brings more the wild nature of the Indians to a gentle constitution than music, and especially the lute. So what I'm wanting to suggest is that this nexus of ideas around science, colonialism, the power of Orpheus's rhetoric is embedded in the very origins of opera, and which opera itself becomes the medium in which these notions of relationships of power and subjectivity become a kind of nexus. The last part of this talk, I'm just going to talk about my own work, my own theatre work. I haven't been able to do as much of it as I would like recently, but I have other heavy, weighty responsibilities. You'll have noticed that my title as professor is not professor just of opera, but professor of opera and music theatre. So why might we be making wanting to make a distinction there? Well, the concept of music theatre is a term that has been used quite often to identify kinds of practice that employ music theatrically, but want to position themselves away from opera. Forms of practice that actually explicitly want to question and challenge some of those ideological underpinnings of opera, some of the ideological framework that is, in a sense, inescapable when you deal with opera in the form that we know it. And what I'm interested in is what I call a critical practice or a post-operatic practice that, rather than just avoiding opera, actually re-engages and interrogates and questions it. And my sort of manifesto comes from Adorno again, good old Adorno. He's such a good standby on these occasions. Music ought to be composed with a hammer, just as Nietzsche wanted to philosophize with a hammer. But that means testing the soundness of the structure, listening with a critical ear for hollow points, not smashing it in two and confusing the jagged remains with avant-garde art. Now, what I'm interested in getting at is some of the ways in which opera exemplifies some core notions of metaphysics in Western metaphysics. Derrida and Barthes have both pointed out that the notion of metaphysics in Western thinking is positive on the idea that that which is within, that which is concealed, is in some sense truer than that which is external or visible. And they show that right from Aristotle through to Hegel through to Heidegger, that this is associated with the idea of the voice and with human subjectivity. The voice comes from within. It is the core of your authenticity. And that which is within is the truest and also that which is invisible. But the second part of this is that subjectivity also has to be universalized. And that is what happens in opera. Wagner is very explicit about this because he says that the orchestra in the pit universalizes the dramatic action, because the music is abstract, it is able in some way to universalize the specific dramatic action that's going on. And he placed his orchestra in a covered pit, so you couldn't see them. The music just emanates without being visible. It is, of course, also a deliberate concealment of the labor of production that's going on in Wagner's sort of metaphysical opera. And if you take a critic like the American critic Herbert Lindenberg, you can see this kind of idea being sort of established as normative to the extent that the composer subjects human actions to the tight logic of musical form and seems to raise these actions to a mythical and more universal level than they achieve through purely verbal expression. Opera impresses its audiences as ultimately more philosophical than spoken drama. So it's really, this is what I'm trying to kind of get at when I'm working with music, theatre, forms of sung drama. And the project I want to talk about was a project that I did with a number of colleagues here in the room, which is very nice they're here as well, Ed Hughes and Candice Cook and Francis Lynch somewhere, who were all members of the team that made this piece. In which we were, the Centre for Research in Opera and Music Theatre was commissioned to make a piece of the World New Music Days in Stuttgart. And we were asked specifically to work with some live audiovisual processing tools. Now, what I was interested in was how the relationship between technology, how technology unpacks some of these, what we might call, metaphysical assumptions of opera. And in particular, in the 19th century, there was a lot of anxiety arising from technologies such as the telephone or the gramophone, because they seemed to, if you could dissociate the voice from the person who was speaking, in some sense that completely unraveled the whole idea of the intimate relationship between authenticity, subjectivity, and voice. And you can see this very clearly in the French symbolist writer Marcel Schwob, when he says, the voice which is the Aryan sign of thought, whence of the soul, that voice that one cannot touch, that one cannot see, that most immaterial of terrestrial things, that which most resembles a spirit, is stolen by the fly of science with a stylet and buried in small holes on a turning cylinder. So what we set out to do with this project was to investigate some of those technologies. And in researching it, I found this page in Friedrich Kittler's book, Gramophone Film Typewriter. And what it is looks like a piece of musical score. What in fact it is a transcription from a phonogram recording of someone suffering from schizophrenia in the 1890s. So someone has recorded this person and then used musical notation to try and analyse their speech patterns. And this was very much part of the whole development of the diagnosis and symptomology of schizophrenia being developed at this time. This is absolutely typical of what was going on. The person who first sort of really identified schizophrenia was M.L. Kraepelin, and he used a lot of these techniques to try and understand all these different problems that people were suffering from. So we made this piece as a way of actually trying to engage with this use of technology that was going on in this period. And basically, very quickly, the piece involves a solo performer who discovers this text, we tried all sorts of different sort of ways of understanding what this text is, but as she does so, some kind of spirit from the past, rather a sort of digital figure, emerges, materializes on a screen. There is just one big screen. And it is a kind of double. It's her and it's not her. It's the historical patient, but it's the same person as she is. And gradually this figure materializes in sort of more kind of concrete form, and this is a sort of shot of her strapped to some device that Kraepelin used a lot of sort of devices like this to try and measure different sorts of pulse rates and so on. And then in this scene, we try to actually imagine the scene of the recording of the phonogram, and that we got a real working phonogram and made a phonogram recording, so in a recording of this text. And gradually what happens is that the live performer increasingly somehow gets merged into the other character, and then eventually she's left, the other character leaves, and she's left actually sort of, she's been kind of taken into the screen image. So I'm just going to play you a very short little clip from our performance. I'm going to put the lights down so you can see it properly. Really what I want to try and get you to think about is how we were trying to take apart some of those sort of conventional assumptions about the relationship between voice, subjectivity, image, subjectivity, sound as something disembodied or embodied, voice that is located in the live performer or the person on the screen, and so on. So let me just take the lights down, and we'll. After this will be basically the end. So, why can I not see the lighting? Lighting, that's right. Off. Thank you. Okay, I hope that you will have picked up from that that there are some references across, for instance, the idea of the technologizing of, particularly here, the female subject in relation to that broader idea of the Orphic mastery of nature as the female subject. So I'm going to finish on that point.